The next matter on calendar, if the parties are here, is Fulbright and Jaworski versus 8th Judicial District Court, number 70059. Give counsel an opportunity to get set up. Mr. Lally, on behalf of petitioner, if you're ready to proceed, please do so. And if you wish to reserve any time.
I would like to reserve 3 minutes, if I may.
That's fine.
The saying, deja vu all over again, never applied to a situation better than it does to us. We've been here before, in December of 2014, in what we've come to refer to as fun. We were in this court, a different building, albeit. We had the same parties, the same personal jurisdiction issues. We had the same law. And importantly, most importantly, we had the same facts. Nothing's changed but the passage of time. Back in 2014 and 2015, when the court's opinion was issued, the court laid out a standard and a roadmap that Verano and the district court would need to follow in order to cure the deficiencies in personal jurisdiction that this court found. That analysis is the appropriate place to start today. The standard, of course, is the purposeful availment standard. And as this court recognized in Fulbright 1 and in numerous other courts, that is not a minimalist standard. Purposeful availment has important language in the way it's articulated by the courts, including this court. Purposeful means just that. Synonyms that the court has used: affirmative contact, targeting contacts. This connotes deliberation, strategy, calculation, not merely incidental contacts. The second thing that the court has noted about the standard is that there must be a clear connection between the substantial, purposeful contacts in the foreign state and the cause of action. The cause of action stated by this plaintiff in this case. And the language there is important too, because the connection is referred to as specific, direct, intimately related, significant, substantial. That is what the court found lacking in Fulbright 1. And it remains lacking in Fulbright 2 because we were here, and while there has been some additional evidence adduced, the additional evidence is not materially or substantively any different from what this court found insufficient in Fulbright 1. The court importantly outlined a roadmap for Verano and for the district court to follow. And there were two important factors there to establish purposeful development. The court said that lacking in Fulbright 1 was anything in the out-of-state attorney-client relationship that is not merely incidental to that. Things like written or oral communications, things like sending bills, or paying for bills. And significantly, the focal point of Fulbright 1 and before us today are two meetings. Two meetings where Fulbright lawyer Jane Maiden went to Nevada and made, as the testimony shows, 2 3- to 5-minute presentations. That is the focal point of minimum contacts here. And
yeah, but wait 1 second. The Fulbright 1 says, in the part that declines to direct dismissal, specifically, although the investor attested to Macon soliciting additional investment funds, Verano's complaint contains no allegation that any additional funds were raised as a result of Macon's solicitations. Now, we do have evidence now in a finding by the district court that there were additional funds raised as a result of the solicitations. So that's changed. And also, I think there's been considerable additional facts on the next part of that final paragraph of before the conclusion of Fulbright 1 about not mentioning VTLM Texas and how that mattered or didn't matter to the investors. I mean, there's a finding that her presence instilled a confidence that all was right within the investment and we need some additional money, but, you know, that it was an imprimatur on the whole project and the solicitation of additional funds. That's the part that's of concern to me. So if you could focus on that, that would help me in analyzing this.
I will. First of all, Justice Pickering, I would say that the points that the district court relied on, which were solicitation advice, legal advice ostensibly given at these two meetings, and the omissions, those were all part of the original complaint. And I direct the court to paragraphs 32 and 41, where you'll see that. And that's why I say there's nothing different here, because Verano has gone back to the same well. And they're still talking about legal advice, solicitation of funds, and omissions, ostensibly, at those two Nevada meetings. Let me tell you why those don't satisfy minimum context. The first threshold issue, as we identified in our complaint, is there wasn't really evidence of that. If one reads the court's opinion carefully, you will see that there were conclusions made that legal advice was given or that funds were solicited. But there's nothing in there. There's no evidence that says Jane Makin said X, and Verano therefore relied on it by doing Y. That's what's lacking, and that's what's necessary here. More importantly, even if we assume for the sake of argument that there was legal advice given and that solicitations were made, that still doesn't rise to the level of minimum context. Remember, we are still talking about something a lawyer does in the capacity of being a lawyer. It is merely incidental to the attorney-client relationship. Those things are simply incidental. It's no different from the Ninth Circuit's opinion on which this court relied in Fulbright 1 that has, you can't think of a better scenario, a more on-point scenario than what we had in that case. And the court said that those communications, even though the lawyer from Florida in that case came to California on three separate occasions to fulfill legal responsibilities, to offer legal services, that wasn't enough because it was random in the sense that the lawyer came at the request of the client. It was fortuitous. The contacts were in California only because the client happened to reside there, and they were attenuated because those meetings were not the basis of any cause of action in the complaint, which is really, furthermore, the problem here with the legal advice and the alleged solicitation of funds. Is they're not connected to a cause of action by Verano, the plaintiff, in this complaint. What you have is an articulation by Verano and the district court that goes something like this. Jane Makin traveled to Nevada on two occasions. She offered legal advice. She participated in the solicitation of funds. The people who were there at the meetings, who were constituents of the limited partner of Verano, they relied on the advice and the solicitation and the omissions, and therefore were induced to invest more money. That's the theory. The problem is there's no cause of action in the complaint that's based upon those Nevada meetings, that solicitation of funds, or the alleged legal advice that still has not been identified. What you have in the complaint are claims against Fulbright and Jaworski and the former general partner for doing things like self-dealing as it related to the formation of entities, the drafting of documents in California. There were alleged conflicts of interest that Fulbright had with the city of San Antonio or Texas A&M University in Texas. There were not contacts in Nevada. So there's no cause of action in the complaint that follows that. And
what do you do, though, with, I mean, I understand that they're taking a small Nevada contact and exponentially increasing it. That's a different issue. But like paragraph 63 of the district court's findings says, After the August 21st meeting, Verano investors Joseph DeSimone and Steve Schneider also invested $200,000 for the express purpose of paying Fulbright's fees. And then they say they did so based in part upon the representations Jane Macon made at the meetings in Las Vegas in 2010. If this were all that was, wouldn't that be enough to give a claim, a jurisdictional presence for purposes of suing to recover the $200,000?
If there were a claim in the complaint for that, it might. There's not a claim in the complaint for the
Why isn't that a subsidiary piece of the breach of fiduciary duty claim? Why isn't that part of that claim?
Well, because it's not alleged in the complaint, and it's barred by any sort of timing that existed in the actual case. By August and September of 2010, when these meetings occurred, the wrongs of which Fulbright is accused already had occurred. They are not being sued for wrongfully soliciting money in those meetings. And what's
so their general prayer for damages doesn't encompass follow-along investments?
If you look at their general prayer for damages, it exists only in the expert report that the district court refused to consider but allowed to be part of this appellate record. There is nothing in there that talks about that. The money, and interestingly, the money that was obtained after the meetings, the chronology is there was a meeting in August, a meeting in September. After the August meeting, the only money that was invested was $20,000. After the September meeting, by November 23rd, the general partner who had hired Fulbright and Jaworski, to whom Fulbright and Jaworski had reported, was replaced by the people who now control Verano. It was after they took over, after they came into the driver's seat, that they invested more money. And it's impossible to attribute that back to meetings prior and to statements of Jane Macon. But more importantly, it's just not the basis of their cause of action. Now, they have tried to argue that they're somehow connected. But the way you know they're not connected is because two things. One is the plaintiff in this case is Verano Land Group. The only people who were at the meetings in Nevada who were induced to invest money, it wasn't Verano. Verano didn't invest money in itself. It was these constituents of the limited partners. And but not only is there not a claim by those people for being wrongfully induced funds, they're not even claims.
Counsel,
that's a different lawsuit.
You're at the 3-minute mark.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones?
May it please the court, my name is Randall Jones. I represent the Verano Land Group. At the risk of sounding trite at the beginning of this process, like I should invoke a statement I'm sure you've all heard before, one that my father was fond of, that if you don't have the law in your favor, you argue the facts, and if you don't have the facts in your favor, you argue the law. And what I heard, and what I believe the appellant is nothing to do with the facts of this case or the law. And you didn't hear anything about the law, the applicable law in this case. So let's go back and starting where
Mr. Jones is on that same venue, so to speak, on that same plane, the issue about the law in the case from the earlier proceedings and the issue within the issue as to whether this was financial solicitation or legal advice. Hopefully you can work that into it.
I absolutely will. In fact, I think that kind of analysis is critical in the context of the law that applies to the facts of this case. But I want to start where Mr. Lawley started about this case is no different than where it was last time we were before you. That is absolutely categorically incorrect. We have had a 6-day evidentiary hearing where 10 witnesses testified and 57 different exhibits were entered into evidence at that time. We have findings of fact, which, as you all have found in Browning versus State, the court has said, findings of fact are entitled to deference and won't be disturbed if supported by substantial evidence.
The issue within for us on that, though, is that we have conclusions, but we don't have reasons for the conclusions. In some cases, as to why we should treat this as legal advice.
Well, I want to get to specifically as to why it's legal advice and some examples where in their brief they say there was no legal advice. There was many instances of legal advice, including one instance that's referenced in our brief by Mr. McGarry that I'd like to mention briefly. Example. At page 39 of our brief, Mr. McGarry testified what would happen that he was told by Ms. Macon. By the way, this is a third incident in the state of Nevada directed at not just an investor, a member of the general partnership, SAM, San Antonio Management. Mr. McGarry was one of the members of the general partnership, so he was no mere investor, although he certainly was an investor as well, and put in additional monies as a direct result of the solicitation and legal advice given to him by Jane Macon the day before one of the two meetings in Las Vegas in 2010, where he was told by Jane Macon what would happen if the funds were not raised from investors and under the circumstances the Verano TERS or TIF would be jeopardized. In other words, what she told him, without informing him, by the way, that the TIF or TERS was not owned by the company that he was investing in, or had already substantially invested in, that if he didn't put up more money and they didn't raise more money, then that TIF was going to be jeopardized. This was an asset that was worth $253 million to the company, except it wasn't the company's. It wasn't under control by the company. And this conspiracy, and by the way, this is a part of a breach of fiduciary duty. It's a part of a malpractice because it was a conflict under Texas law. And I would point out to this court, the appellate here talks about, and they fought hard to have Texas law apply in this case, but I find it illuminating that they don't mention once in either of their two briefs, either the Beck case or the Murphy case or the Camilco case. There's another case we cited, Juan Pac. All those cases go directly to the issue of what is the cause of action that has been that arises in this case? And I would like to talk about those cases for a moment that they don't talk about at all. This is the law that applies to whether or not a cause of action occurred. It just as to the breach of fiduciary duty. In Beck versus Law Office of Edwin Perry, a fiduciary duty required of Macon and Fulbright under Texas law was one of absolute perfect candor, openness and honesty, and the absence of any concealment or deception. First of all, have to be absolutely honest and candid. You don't come into Las Vegas and meet with these investors, including members of the general partner, and don't tell them your largest asset that you think you own, you don't own that. Beck says they have an absolute duty to not conceal or be deceptive in any way, shape, or form. That is a breach of fiduciary duty under Texas law. Murphy versus Gruber. Failing to disclose a conflict is an actionable breach of fiduciary duty by a lawyer in Texas. Texas law. The Locke case, this is 2010. Omission and anything less than complete honesty is an actionable breach of duty in Texas. That's exactly what Judge Al found. That the, at a minimum, the omission of these material facts, and how could anybody argue candidly that not telling the company that when it believes it has a $250 million asset, that it's truly actually controlled by three other people that have complete control over that asset? And by the way,
but their argument is you haven't pleaded that caused legal injury for which recompense is sought by your clients, as I understand what they're saying.
Well, that's certainly what I heard Mr. Lawley say. As we all know, and Mr. Lawley, I know, is from Utah. I don't know what Utah law is. I know here we have a plain and simple statement. We do not have to plead like California, where you plead intimate details of every claim. And how could you do that? This is a conspiracy. And by the way, we have evidence that was adduced at this evidentiary hearing going back to the creation of VTLM with Fulbright, was a direct conflict of interest with their other client, Verano. Then they have a meeting in February 2010, leading up to these other meetings, where they, and that's in the record, respondents appendix 175, internal notes from a partner at Fulbright. Ms. Macon was at that meeting where they talk about creating BTLM and giving BTLM this right of first refusal, create leverage over their other client, Verano. That's a part of the conspiracy. It's also a conflict of interest. It's also a breach of fiduciary duty. That was in furtherance of the conspiracy that was ultimately further carried out in August and September of 2010. Those directly relate to our claims for relief, for conspiracy, breach of fiduciary duty, and conflict of interest.
Mr. Jones, yeah, so your position is under the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure that claims you've made in the complaint under notice pleading are sufficient to carry these allegations forward. Is that correct?
Honor, you just put that much more succinctly than I just did.
Okay. Yeah,
that's exactly what I'm
saying. Well, I just want to make sure as we can go on to the next point. Okay, well, now, the main issue today is whether there is specific personal jurisdiction over Fulbright, Jaworski, and Ms. Macon in Nevada, because we've heard about Texas law and San Antonio and all these other things. So, well, let's focus on Nevada. Now, tell me succinctly, and I've read the decision and order from Judge Alf, but what did they do in Nevada? Who did they say what to in Nevada? If you can summarize that for me, that you feel is grounds for specific personal jurisdiction and where you disagree with Mr. Lawley, his characterization of the facts.
I'd be happy to. By the way, I believe that creating BTLM was a part of a conspiracy, the furtherance of which occurred in the state of Nevada when they came here as part of furtherance of that conspiracy. Conspiracy, as we all know, doesn't just happen at one point in time. Coming to Nevada in August of 2010, in furtherance of that conspiracy, under law of this case, that applies to this case, Texas law, the standard of which they had to comply, they had an absolute duty of honesty and no concealment or deception. Met with Mr. McGarry, first of all, and another meeting outside the meeting with the group.
This is in Nevada.
In Las Vegas, that's
okay.
Correct.
Okay.
They talked about what they were going to do at the presentation with the investors, and he was told, legal advice. You need to get this money raised because if you don't, your TERS is going to be jeopardized. Your TERS, Verano's TERS, not VTLM's TERS. That's first of all, that's a lie. Secondly, it was a concealment of the fact that the other entity owned it. Second incidence. By the way, I would argue that this conspiracy was ultimately played out in Las Vegas. It started well before.
Well, Mr. McGarry is a member of the State Bar in Nevada, so correct. So
he was
there as an attorney or as an investor?
He was there as a general partner.
Okay.
A member of the general partnership, Sam.
Mm-hmm.
As well as, I believe, Mr. Workman, who was also a general partner, was at that meeting where they talked about the PowerPoint. The PowerPoint, which was entered into evidence at the evidentiary hearing, went through in great detail a legal analysis of the terms and what it was about that was brought to Las Vegas. Ms. Macon made comment and had input into that PowerPoint, which had legal analysis and advice in it, which is a part of what Judge Alf found. That was presented at the meeting to the investors. Then you have the meeting with the investors. And I can read that it's starting on about page 37 of our brief, where Mr. Schneider testified about what the legal advice was. He said the infrastructure of the Verano project came from Ms. Macon. She talked about that. The plans to convince the Texas A&M University to open a branch in Verano. The presence of a Toyota plant near the property, and generally the fact that the Verano project was proving to be a good investment. Then there's a second meeting where the same kind of thing occurs. Mr. Jaffe, he started asking questions, and his testimony was when he started asking questions that appeared to be troublesome. They told Ms. Macon to go over to him and say, "Look, here's my business card. I'll talk to you, if you have any other questions, I'll talk to you later." Her lawyer business card. By the way, Judge Al found, based on her own testimony, that Ms. Macon stood up in front of that group and said, "I'm an attorney with Fulbright Jaworski," and had her business cards there. It defies credulity to think that a lawyer would stand up in front of a group of investors where she knows the purpose of the meeting is to solicit funds. That evidence is well established. It's in the record. It should be given deference under Browning versus State. There's no contradictory evidence. She knew the purpose of the meeting was to solicit funds. If that's in furtherance of the conspiracy, that alone would give rise to jurisdiction. She came here to help convince these people to put up more money to invest. And in fact, the court found, in reliance upon her statements, at least in part, people put up a minimum of $480,000 additional dollars. So Mr. Wortman testified that, quote, this is the petitioner's appendix at 1685. They were significantly misled as it related to the assets that should have been in this in the Verona Group. I believe the TERS issue is a very big issue, and it has been fully resolved in this, nor should it be in this courtroom, but it is a $256 million asset that is in someone else's hands. And I believe that we were misled as to who had the value of the TERS, and it remains that way to this day. I told you about Mr. Jaffe. Mr. Olson testified that he heard Ms. Macon say it was a good investment. And by the way, remember, the testimony is she knew, she helped prepare a capital call letter in the summer of 2010, as well as a notice of a preemptive rights letter, and was told by Mr. Lantman, one of the co-conspirators, when she drafted the letter, to dumb it down so that investors wouldn't really understand what it was that they were having to come up with the money for, which she obliged.
Mr. Jones
did that.
In Fulbright 1, the court made certain findings. What is so different now that those findings should not apply as law of the case?
Findings in Fulbright 1?
Yeah.
Well, the distinction is a six-day evidentiary hearing where you have...
But what was different in the evidentiary hearing? What new facts were adduced that take us outside of the law of the case from the first one?
Most specifically, Justice Douglas, most specifically. Justice Hardesty, I remember specifically saying to me, look, was any other money invested in reliance upon and misspent in reliance upon any statements by Ms. Macon at the time? We now have uncontroverted factual findings that under Browning versus State must be given deference by this court. In fact, right before this argument, I heard Justice Gibbons acknowledge that this body is not a fact-finding body. This body relies on the facts of the lower court. The lower court, I've got a total of, I could go page after page. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
The last matter was a writ. This is a straight appeal. We have a record in front of us, and we have a record from the prior. It's a writ also. I'm sorry.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I guess if...
Give you another minute, and I'll add a minute.
I would just answer your last question specifically. This is a finding number 68. Therefore, at least $480,000 was invested in Verano after the Las Vegas meeting, $30,000 from the Wortman Group, $220,000 from the DeSimone Schneider Group, and $230,000 from the McGarry Group. And at least partial reliance on the legal advice and analysis of Jane Macon in those Las Vegas meetings, in addition to the money raised from investors, Joe DeSimone invested $1.1 million personally, based at least in part in reliance on Macon's advice and analysis, and all of the people I just mentioned, the names, those were all members of the general partnership, so the argument that they were somehow or other not the client is incorrect. Thank you.
Any additional questions?
I have one. What you just went through, paragraph 68, tie that, if you will, to your claims in your complaint and the prayers for damages.
I'll be happy to, Your Honor. With respect to the conspiracy, the whole idea here is, remember, this has to be viewed in context of the Beck case and the other Texas.
I understand
case.
That.
So by omitting the fact that she came here, this absolute duty of candor and honesty, we have a breach of fiduciary duty claim. Texas law is clear. Not revealing that material fact is a breach of fiduciary duty. We have a breach of fiduciary duty claim. We have a conspiracy claim. By coordinating with the other general manager, the Triple L people, in misleading these people, including the other general managers, in soliciting these funds, that's a conspiracy. That is actionable under the claims that we have made in a notice pleading state. Finally, it is a conflict of interest under Nevada law, under both Nevada and Texas law, to not reveal the conflict to your client when you know about it. That's a violation of Texas law. So we have a conflict of interest malpractice claim that we have alleged against Fulbright and Jaworski. So there are at least three claims that we have pled that are directly supported by the facts in this case and the applicable law to the facts. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel will give you a full 2 additional minutes to your time.
Thank you. I just have a few short points. First goes to this issue we're discussing about the funds. And it really applies to the legal advice as well. I agree with Justice Douglas that the district court has not made findings of fact that legal advice was given or the funds. There are conclusions, certainly, but there's no evidence to support those other than generalizations and conclusory statements. Nevertheless, let us assume for the sake of argument that legal advice was given and that funds were solicited. The question still remains, do those actions in Nevada connect to the causes of action? And they do not, for a very simple and clear reason. Let us assume that this wrongful solicitation of claims were a cause of action in the complaint. It is not. The reason it is not is because the individuals from whom the money was allegedly being solicited are not plaintiffs. They have no causes of action in any complaint. If we were here in a different case where the constituents of the limited partners were suing to get a refund of the investments they'd made based upon Jane Makin's statements, we might have a jurisdictional issue. That is not our case. So the money, any money that came in, it is not a cause of action for
this. But isn't their theory that the investors gave the money to Verano, who in turn gave it as directed to this enterprise?
That is what it is, but it doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't solve the problem because the constituents of the limited partners are not Verano. They might have a separate claim.
Right, but then Verano gives the money to Fulbright. I mean, isn't that their theory?
They
gave it to Verano to give it to Fulbright.
Money went to Fulbright only after the new general partner, the complainants, took over. They're the ones who decided to give the money to Fulbright, not the first general partner. Nevertheless, there's no cause of action in the complaint for that. The professional negligence and the fiduciary duty claims that they purport to tie us, they're based on activity that occurred in Texas.
What's not based on the activity. Justice Gibbons' point that we're essentially notice pleading and
it's
not Rule 9 pleading?
I'm not disputing that in the least, but you have to have the right plaintiff.
Right.
And we don't have that. Second, let's not forget omissions. Reading the court's opinion carefully, the district court, and Verano's papers carefully, this really boils down to omissions. Jane Makin should have disclosed in those meetings. Is that 4 minutes?
Go ahead.
Okay. Jane Makin should have disclosed in those meetings. Omissions, as a matter of law, are not the basis for minimum contacts. There is no court that any party has cited who says that. We've cited to this court numerous cases that say an omission is analytically the opposite of an action of a minimum contact that can establish personal jurisdiction.
Right, but if you solicit and you omit to tell true facts and you gain money as a result of the solicitation, then it's a mix. It's solicitation and omission.
Well, if the omission is proper in the context, which it isn't, and again, that's not a cause of action. Let me conclude with this one point, and it goes to a question Justice Gibbons asked, which is, and it really goes to the reasonableness element here, which is the final point in the analysis for personal jurisdiction. It should be easy to say Jane Makin went to Nevada and did ABC, and it resulted in X, Y, and Z. We don't have that. More importantly, let me ask the court to undertake an analytical test and assume that the two meetings in Nevada never happened. Erase them from the equation and ask, would Verano still have their claims for nondisclosure and omission? Would they still have their claims for conspiracy? Would any of their claims differ? Would any of the elements of proof differ? Would anything, any of the facts differ? And the answer is no. You could eliminate those meetings from the entire equation of this lawsuit, and it wouldn't make a bit of difference to their claims, to the evidence, to anything. That tells you that there is no substantial connection between the Nevada meetings and their claims.
Before you sit down, Mr. Jones raised the Browning case out of Texas. Any comment on that case in terms of the fiduciary duty?
The fiduciary duty is not the issue for the day. The fiduciary duty is what Mr. Jones articulated. That's a question that goes to the merits of the case. And it doesn't matter for purposes of personal jurisdiction because it doesn't change the contacts and it doesn't change the connection to the causes of action.
Thank you. Thank counsel for both sides for their arguments this day, providing additional information to clarify what is presented to this court. This matter will stand submitted. We are now in recess.